is Scott Bowden. Scott is a graduate of Texas Christian University in Fort Worth.
Jeff's still over the top.
His first book that he co-authored is a groundbreaking study of Napoleon using unpublished documents from the French Army archives. While doing his work on the French Napoleonic Wars, he came across and explored the 19th American military beginnings with the armies of the 1st Manassas, published in 1988, and the armies of Gettysburg, published in 1988 also. Scott's 2001 landmark piece, The Last Chance of Victory, Robert E. Lee and the Gettysburg Campaign, is considered by many to be the definitive study of Robert E. Lee's 1863 Pennsylvania campaign. His most recent book is, again, about Lee, Robert E. Lee at War, The Mind and Method of a Great American Soldier. Scott Bowden.
Thank you, Ed. Everybody, is that clear? Is that all good? When Bragg called me to come speak this weekend, he reminded me the high standards of the S.D. Lee Institute and how I would have to probably read my presentation. Well, naturally, that conjured up in my mind the story of the Army maneuvers prior to World War II. It was in 1937, and I believe it was in Kansas. The Army was having a series of maneuvers, and the briefing that was to be held prior to that Saturday, the Chief of Staff, which was a major, was to brief all the officers in the room about what was getting ready to happen. And the officer, being forgetful, did not bring his notes with him. And so as he's fumbling around saying, you know, God, excuse me, gentlemen, I have forgotten my notes, there's this voice in the audience said, well, you don't need them, just tell us about it. And he said, well, yes, sir, I do need my notes. I have to excuse myself and go get it. And the voice in the audience said, if you know your subject matter, you can talk for 45 minutes without notes. And the major again said, well, no, sir, that's impossible. You can't talk for 45 minutes without your notes. The voice said, sit down, Major. And up rose Chief of Staff George C. Marshall, who came to the podium and gave a 45-minute dissertation on Winfield Scott's Anaconda Plan. Well, with all due respect to General Marshall, there's so many quotations I've got to go through today that I cannot memorize all of them. So I am going to read the prepared the notes that I have and try to intersperse them with a few stories that will hopefully resonate with you. Hopefully you'll hear some things about Robert E. Lee today that you haven't heard before, as difficult as that may sound. I'm hopeful that I will achieve that goal. Now, my talk today is You Have Only to Blow the Bugle, Robert E. Lee, the War and its Aftermath. And now, with any larger-than-life figure, Robert E. Lee and his so-called popular place in American history is a combination of fact and myth. I would think that if anybody, most people in this room, if you closed your eyes and someone said, Robert E. Lee, the image that would come to your mind would be probably this one. Would it not? This, a portrait of Lee made in Julius Vanderson's studio in Richmond in January 64 is considered one of the most popular images of the general. However, when I speak about Robert E. Lee, this is the image that I see. The image painted by Benjamin Franklin Reinhart in Richmond in April of 1861. It was finished and published in Paris in 1862. But I think that for us to cut through the myth and see the real man, we have to look at Lee this way. We have to look at him anew. And hopefully I'll be able to do that today, because in order to have an accurate portrait of him and what he saw as a result of 1865, I think we have to consider his life and his army experiences in their proper context. And in order to do that, we've got to go through that very rapidly. Because from the time that he finally got his overdue chance to command an army, and that was June 1st, 1862, more than 14 months after the war began, and up until the fateful morning at Appomattox almost 3 years later, now Robert E. Lee stood astride the North American continent like a colossus. Following the war until his death in 1870, the long shadow of his service and dedication formed the very foundation of the sacredness of the cause embraced by Southerners of that generation and since. Thus, in the next little while, I need to describe the man by placing his actions and words in their proper historical context, and properly framed, it is hoped then that we're armed with the facts and we can better understand the man Winfield Scott called, and I quote, the greatest living soldier in America. Now, Robert Edward Lee was a thoroughly professional and extraordinarily gifted soldier. In his more than 30 years of service in federal government, he forged a reputation of many traits that included unquestioned bravery and possessing an uncanny knack to quickly and accurately assess terrain and enemy dispositions in a twinkling of an eye. It was what Napoleon called the coup d'oeil, the glance of an eye. Now, when the sectional crisis exploded in the late 1860, and though opposing secession, Lee, in the traditional view of Jeffersonian democracy, believed that, quote, a union which can be maintained by bayonets has little charm for me, close quote. Now, confiding to another, Lee proclaimed, again a quote, I cannot raise my hand against my birthplace, my home, my children, close quote. That's thus when Virginia delegates finally voted to leave the Union in response to Lincoln's call for 75,000 volunteers in April 61, which you all know that part of that quota were to be Virginians to form an army to invade the so-called cotton states. Lee knew full well that Virginia's departure from the Union was a given, even with the public referendum soon to follow. It was going to be voted in May. And Lee also understood that Virginia's departure from the Union released, ipso facto, her citizens as well. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I believe that those today who try to mold Lee through the myth that he could have just as easily stayed in his federal uniform as he did, in their mind, discarded it. To those who raised the specter that it was for selfish economic reasons tied to his wife's side of the family that swayed his decision to throw in his lot with Virginia, and to those who point to Winfield Scott and George Thomas as examples of Virginians who remained loyal in the federal service, and that Lee could have and should have easily acted the same, to those myth creators, I doubt if a single one of them has ever read the great Roman historian Tacitus's book, Germania, which was one of Lee's favorite works. Now, in those pages, Tacitus discusses the underpinnings of Western civilization, for it was the defense of family and the importance to uphold the honor of one's blood and home that outweighed all other considerations or fealty. And if the mythmakers ever followed or ever studied fellow Virginian George Thomas, they would be aware that it was his northern bride that wore the pants in his family. And if the mythmakers ever closely studied Winfield Scott, they would know that it would have been impossible for Scott to throw in his lot with a new republic headed by his most hated mortal enemy, Jefferson Davis. So the fact that Lee was forced to choose between defense of family and kin as opposed to remaining in the service of the federal government should only elevate his standing in the eyes of us who can realistically grasp the intellectual honesty of a man or a woman who views their honor and importance of their family. This is why that although someone may honestly disagree with a decision made by a person in history, we might as well, at the same time, take him or her at their word as to why they acted the way they did. Thus, Lee's decision to defend his family and side with what he defined as his home, that being the state of Virginia, was in fact his view of honor. Now, in my current work, the Robert E. Lee at War series, I characterize Lee as a tragic secessionist. I think anyone who studies and dispassionately analyzes Lee's decision to side with Virginia will discover that he had absolutely no illusions about the difficulty facing the Confederacy or what was at stake if the bold gambit failed. This is revealed in many of his writings and conversations. Lee understood that in going to war against a federal government that had a standing army, a standing navy, the institutional financial stability, and the factories to more readily prosecute the war, that every Southern man and every Southern woman had to do his or her part in order for the Confederacy to have a chance at winning independence. Further, Lee knew that only Southerners could deliver themselves from the weighty consequences of the conflict, and that failure would bring unimaginable difficulties entailing a lost way of life, forfeiture of possessions, and worse. In Lee's opinion, if the experiment failed, those who risked secession would lose everything, with the lone exception, as he famously described, save that of honor. Who today, I wonder, would risk everything, and I mean everything, to save that of honor? I'm sure everybody here realizes that the courage necessary to realistically face such a choice is obviously and sadly lost on those who criticize Lee, as well as our forefathers, for making the choice of defending their homes. Now, however, once the tragic secessionist became a revolutionary, he was fully committed to the cause for Southern independence. His writings, his conversations leave no doubt about the commitment Lee believed necessary in order to have a chance to win. And just a sampling of these reveals Lee's core beliefs. Now, Walter Taylor, who was Lee's longest tenured aide, stated that in the spring of 61, Lee was the only man that he knew in Richmond who believed that the war would go on for many years and that the cost would be greater than what the forefathers experienced during the American War for Independence. Taylor, whose sentiments were also echoed by another one of Lee's aides, that being Charles Marshall, plainly stated that Lee spoke of the full commitment that he was making to the cause and how others must be fully awakened to the same level of commitment. This is a quote by Lee. Let danger never turn you aside from the pursuit of honor or the service to your country. And then he added, know that death is inevitable and the fame of virtue is immortal. Now, when in June 62, Lee began to mold his inherited army that was before Richmond into his image, and there was a lot of work to be done on that because that army needed a heck of a lot of work to be done to it. To give you just an example, there was no discipline in the army. If you can believe it, Joe Johnston ran this army where anybody could absent themselves any time for any reason and go anywhere they wanted to. Now, what constrained them was money, okay? But the officers who had money, they could go into Richmond anytime they wanted to and party with the babes, you know? And they could absent themselves for any reason at any time. This is the mess that Lee inherited when he rose to command in June 62. Okay? Now, to stop this nonsense and to have an army that could stand up to this well-organized machine that was outside, 5 miles outside of Richmond, and to impress upon the soldiers the unswerving conviction that they needed for the fight that lay ahead, Lee directed his division commanders to impress upon their commands what exactly was at stake. And I think it is representative of the proclamation that was made by James Longstreet to his division. This communique is dated June 1762. Now, listen to Longstreet's words. "Your foes have declared their purpose of bringing you to beggary, and avarice, their natural characteristic, incites them to redouble efforts for the conquest of the South in order that they may seize her sunny fields and happy homes. If ever men were called upon to defend the beloved daughters of their country, that now is our duty. Let such thoughts nerve you up to the most dreadful shock of battle." And then this part is emphasized, underlined in the original. "For were it certain death, death would be better than the fate that defeat would entail upon us." But remember, though the fiery noise of battle is indeed most terrifying and seems threatening universal ruin, it is not so destructive as it seems, and few soldiers, after all, are slain. This the commanding general desires." Close quote. Now that, to me, is powerful stuff. It's patriotic, and it's also realistic. Yet despite Lee's own abundant evidence that not only he but everybody in Dixie had to do everything in their power to positively affect the outcome and achieve the political imperative, now, there's no shortage of writers who would try to wrap Lee's decision as an army commander around the specious idea that his decisions were tied to some hope for European intervention. They do this in the attempt to paint Lee's command decisions to take the army north of the Potomac in 62 and again in 63 as part of a fantasy that Lee was trying to effect foreign intervention. Now, interestingly, those who paint Lee's in this myth evidently hadn't read Lee's own words about the subject, but they also suffer from the historical amnesia about the official visit of Napoleon III's emissary to Richmond in May of 62. And you remember that in May of 62, Lee was acting as President Davis's so-called advisor. Now, Count Mercier, who was a minister for Napoleon III, along with French consul Paul, delivered a communique to President Davis that plainly spelled out that France would recognize the Southern Confederacy and declare in support for the Southern war effort only if a bill came through the Confederate Congress outlining when emancipation would be granted, even if it was, quote, a gradual abolition of slavery in 50 or 60 years, close quote. Now, if that were done by the Confederate Congress and signed by Davis, the Count Mercier and Consul Paul said that the French honor would be upheld and that they would be the first foreign power to ally with Richmond. Lee was aware of all this at the time, and when he found out that such a bill was not forthcoming, that was combined with another act that had a very deadly affliction upon the army, that being his drastic alteration of the Conscription Act that he had authored the previous month, then he knew, he had no illusions that it was Southerners and only Southerners could secure their own future. This is what Lee says, quote, "Our country demands all our strength, all our energies. To resist the powerful combinations against us will require every man at his place. If victorious, we will have everything to hope for. In the future, if defeated, nothing will be left to us to live for. Another one of the facts that helps us fully realize how Lee was fully committed to the and embraced the gravity of the situation was made his decision to side with his native state was his often repeated and favorite motto, conquer or die. Okay? Lee used the phrase time and again from 61 through 65. The use conquer or die appears in his general orders, his communiques, his discussions with his subordinates, and as well as during his innumerable inspections to the camp, army camps, beginning 2 days after he rose to command of the army. Now, this repeated phrase permeates Lee's command stint, reveals his purpose being singular, and he was moved to better motivate his subordinates and achieve the young republic's goal of independence. Now, how did Lee do this on a personal level? It's a pretty interesting story. During the summer of 62, while he was in the midst of the summer campaigns, that being the 7 days, Second Manassas, leading on into Maryland, he comes up with the idea that he needs to have some way to recognize deserving officers and soldiers. Now, by law, he has no authority to raise anybody at any rank. He can't even by his command give a private a raise to a corporal. Okay? So Lee hatches this idea. And he sends gold through the lines to the Copperheads in the Cincinnati area. He instructs them to manufacture pincushions. On the one side was a First National flag. Underneath it, his motto, conquer or die. And on the reverse, they were images of roses from his wife's rose garden in Arlington because he loved when he was there every morning to go out to the rose garden and clip some roses and bring them to Mary. And underneath it was a scroll with one big word that said love with a line and then a space to write somebody's name. Okay? Now, when Lee got those, and following the campaigns of the summer of 62, while he was reorganizing the army in October 62, he began to institute what was known as the presentation of the pincushions. Now, his staff had done all the work. Lee had seen a lot of these guys fight under his eyes for all summer. And they were able to select the deserving officers and soldiers. So Lee would, unannounced, as he would usually do, appear at the regimental camps. They would muster the guys in on parade, and then he would call the deserving soldiers forward to give them a pincushion. He would give them thanks for their service to the cause, and by doing that, he puts pressure on the superiors to give them a promotion, right? He also has another thing that he does by this. Obviously, he's giving support and encouragement to the enemies of the Lincoln administration. But more importantly, what's this soldier going to do when he gets a pincushion? He's going to send it home. Look what General Lee gave me. Okay? And so, in one fell swoop, he accomplishes so many things, including the support of the Southern women, and that, you can get into how Lee handled women's visits to camps to see men, but he would always meet every one of them before they met with their officer husbands or significant others. And many times, you would see these correspondence of somebody going to see his wife or girlfriend and having one of these in hand to give to her. It was a brilliant stroke, and it's an interesting story to let you know not only the depth of his commitment, but also his understanding of the human condition. Now, anyone hearing all this for the first time might think that Lee's personal aura was pretty powerful. And indeed it was. Erasmus Keyes, who was an officer that served with Lee in the Antebellum Army, as well as commanded a corps in the Army of the Potomac against Lee during the war, I think said it best. He said, even though Lee was exempt from every form and degree of snobbery, his sense of superiority and fitness to command were undeniable. No man could stand in his presence and not recognize his capacity and acknowledge his moral force. That's the quote. Now, this superiority and presence, as Erasmus Keyes said, stretched not only across boardrooms and meeting rooms, but it also stretched across battlefields. There could be no question that federal commanders sensed Lee's superiority, as they admitted this to the same in others in blue uniform. Now, when George McClellan returned to the undulating fields along the Antietam Creek in 1864, after that was two summers after he had commanded the Federal Army in the bloodiest day in American military history, McClellan recalled that Lee's battlefield prowess at Sharpsburg was the equivalent of being an extra 40,000 men. Now, that's a remarkably similar statement to the one made by the Duke of Wellington when he equated Napoleon's military presence on the battlefield to a like number of combatants. So without question, Lee's daring maneuvers and victories had made an indelible mark on the institutional memory of the Army of the Potomac. We can see this, that why that is that during the Battle of the Wilderness in May 64, Grant overhears his subordinates who have lived the experience with Lee's daring maneuvers express their reservations as to about what the Confederate general may attempt. Grant loses his temper and explodes in a rage, quote, "Oh, I'm hardly tired of hearing about what Lee is going to do. Some of you always seem to think that he's suddenly going to turn a double somersault and land in our rear and on both flanks at the same time. Go back to your command and try to think of what we're going to do ourselves instead of what Lee's going to do to us." That's the quote by Grant. Now, even as the war dragged on into its last year, Lee's commitment and determination to conquer or die was as strong as ever. We see that on the morning of April 9, 1865 at Appomattox. Now, the Army of Northern Virginia is surrounded on three sides. The only way that was not barred was due north, which they can't go that way. And Lee's men and animals were starving. They hadn't had a meal in 5 days. Think about that. Now, his officers that morning, in order to put something into their stomach, mixed their shaving soap with water in their biscuits and ate the mixture for breakfast. The horses and the mules, in their desperation to find anything to put in their stomachs, were seen eating the bark off all the trees in the area. Okay? Now, amidst this scene of desperation, Lee is still looking for a way to continue the fight. And if there's any one thing about Appomattox that everybody should remember, that it is this, is that with his army cut off and starving, he committed it to an attack in an attempt to break out of the encirclement. And when, after the attack's initial success, it became obvious that escape was impossible, Lee asked his principal lieutenants if, in essence, a Viking funeral of the Army of Northern Virginia would any way further the cause. And when their response came back that sacrificing the army would not help, Lee said, quote, "I suppose there is nothing for me to do but go see General Grant, and you know the rest of it, and I would rather die 1,000 deaths. Now, I believe that all these aforementioned facts allow us a realistic view of just how intent Lee was in winning the war. And that once he joined the revolutionaries, he was consistent in his dedication to Southern independence and in his determination, as he so often put it, to conquer or die. However, once the war was over, Lee was the first to acknowledge that his, as the position of a former commanding general of the South's one successful and principal army, required that he be the voice of reconciliation in order for Southerners to make the best of what was left of their lives amidst a miserable situation. Now, after all, who better than Lee fully knew about the sacrifices caused by the war, about homes lost, worldly possessions despoiled by invading armies? It was Lee. And who, after all, knew better than Lee himself about the scrutiny that he would be subjected to in the post-war society? Lee, therefore, decided the very day he surrendered the army that to best facilitate reconciliation between the sections, he had to be, as far as the public was concerned, a model citizen, just as he had always strived to be a model soldier. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's crucial to understand that what Lee did and said publicly did not necessarily equate to how he felt privately, okay? I think all of us understand that men and women in the public eye may say officially what does not necessarily mean how they feel privately, and they don't have to like what it is that they're saying. I think all of us are realistic enough to know this. And it's just as common sense about the way the world works. And although we know that Lee was certainly not a duplicitous man, we can leave the conference with the confidence in knowing in our hearts and our heads that what Lee publicly avowed privately, he really didn't like the situation. Okay? Now, how do we know this to be true? How can we be comfortable in our understanding of Lee and his consistent character during the war and afterward? I think the answer lies in Lee's actions as well as in his written word that are consistent with his actions and conversations during and following the war. And since the focus of the conference here today is about the legacy of the war, let me explain or explore just a little bit some of the reputed conversations Lee had about post-war society and how things were turning out for his beloved Virginia and the South. The first of these are at an informal gathering of former officers attended by Lee in the summer of 68. At this, it was former general, Federal General William Rosecrans, and who was also there. And Rosecrans asked Lee if he could, as a voice of reconciliation, give his assurance of the South's loyalty to the Union. Lee demurred. He wouldn't do it. Rosecrans, who was a Democrat, mentioned that the Republicans were making every attempt to heighten alarm in the North by forming this picture of Southerners as unreconcilable, and that in order to punish them, harsh policies were needed for the subjugated region. Now, other Southerners at the gathering included General Beauregard and Vice President Alexander Stevens. And those two men and others assured Rosecrans that the defeated former Confederates were indeed willing to support the Union, because after all, what choice did they have? The last man to speak on the subject was former Provisional Governor of Texas, Fletcher Stockdale. And he told Rosecrans that the South would keep the peace, but he warned that the winds blowing from the radicals were not anything akin to folks interested in amicably reuniting a previously divided country. Stockdale told Rosecrans that Southerners were not dogs to lick the hand of those who kicked it. The meeting ends soon thereafter, and as the men filed out of the room, Stockdale and Lee were reputedly the last ones remaining, at which time Lee supposedly thanked Stockdale for what he had said and added, quote, "Governor, if I had foreseen the use those people desired to make of their victory, there would have been no surrender at Appomattox. No, sir, not by me. Had I foreseen the results of subjugation, I would have preferred to die at Appomattox with my brave men, my sword in this right hand." Close quote. Now, I use the term reputedly and supposedly because the conversation comes to us through Robert Louis Dabney, who says that Stockdale told him of this conversation with Lee. It's noteworthy, ladies and gentlemen, that Lee biographers shy away from this quote and citing this story for various reasons. However, none of the biographers attempt to place the alleged conversation in context with the rest of Lee's life and Lee's actions. So each of us here today must ask ourselves this question. Does the conversation Lee had with Stockdale sound like it came from the same man that on the morning of Appomattox was still looking for a way to continue the war, and when no alternative was left, he said, "Well, there's nothing left for me to do but go see General Grant, and I would rather die 1,000 deaths." I think it sounds like the same man to me. In another reputed conversation by Lee, brought to us by Gerald Smythe, this one from Major Talcott of Lee's staff, Lee supposedly told Talcott in Richmond, I believe the conversation was in 69, that he would have never surrendered the army had he known how the South would have been treated. According to the story, Talcott responded, "Well, General, you have only to blow the bugle." Lee responded, "It's too late now." Again, biographers reject the story because they don't look at Lee's life in context. And again, we have to ask ourselves, is this consistent with what we know about General Lee? In my mind, I believe it sounds like the same man. But there is another parallel issue that goes along with these conversations. Because whenever folks like you and me come across those who today reject the idea that Lee held private views counter to those he espoused publicly, and in the rejection of those, call those who bring us the conversations of Stockdale and Talcott as being figments of their imagination, remember this. To call someone a liar is, by every means measurable, a remarkable claim. And more importantly, those who cry foul forget the time period and the society involved, whereas a man's or woman's word was their bond, and to lie would bring dishonor upon themselves and their house and their families. Therefore, what remarkable evidence does anyone have to support the assertion that the authors relaying these stories from Talcott and Doc Stockdale are liars? And I'll tell you the answer, they have none. But to where the detractors who willingly denigrate the idea of Lee siding with his native state or lamenting the results of the war can never raise the specter of hearsay evidence with regard to Lee's post-war correspondence with the English politician John Dalbert Acton, better known as Lord Acton. Now, Acton took a great interest in American history and politics, and after the war, he wrote Lee a very lengthy letter dated November 4, 1866, and he tells Lee that he saw in states' rights the only availing check upon the absolutism of sovereign will, meaning Lincoln, and secession filled me with hope, not as the destruction, but as the redemption of democracy. I deem that you were fighting the battles for your liberty, our progress, and our civilization. Close quote. Lord Acton goes on to state, "And I mourn for the stake which was lost at Richmond more deeply than I rejoice over that which was saved at Waterloo." Now, let me stop here and say that as a Napoleonic historian, I can't imagine a statement more confused with the facts than Acton's comparison of British fighting at Waterloo and the Confederates fighting outside of Richmond. And would you have to remember that it was Lee himself who used three derogatory names for his adversary, the most famous being those people, the second being the Philistines, the third being the British. Okay? Those were Lee's three names for his adversaries, those three again. Everybody knows those people. The second was that he used often was the Philistines, and the third being the British. Any student of Waterloo knows that the soldiers fighting at Waterloo were fighting for empire, continued global economic superiority, expansionism, and the shameless exploitation of humanity. It was certainly not the French soldiers who, in earlier campaigns, had got into battles beneath the standards of red, white, and blue that proclaimed liberty, equality, and fraternity. Now, that patriotic confusion aside, Acton's comment is a testament to how highly the Englishman valued the cause for Southern independence. And now Lee's response to Acton is noteworthy because there's absolutely no doubt as to how Lee viewed the matters of American democracy, secession, and the results of the war. In a long letter dated the 15th of December, 1866, as Lee writes back to Acton, he spells things out, and I'll take just a couple of minutes to point out and comment on just a couple of these things. Quote, "The importance of the question now at issue in the United States involving not only constitutional freedom and constitutional government in this country, but the progress of universal liberty and civilization is a concern to everybody." Now, in this, Lee expresses that those Southerners who had lived the war now wondered if and how the war was going to be used to the advantage of the North. Quote, It will be no easy task to discover the truth, meaning the direction the federal government's going to take, or to relieve it, meaning the truth, from the mass of prejudice and passion with which it has been covered by party spirit, meaning the prejudice and the passion of the radical Republicans. Lee then kind of hits his stride in this letter with the following sentences and makes his prediction for the future. Very interesting. "I can only say that while I have considered the preservation of the constitutional power of the federal government to the foundation of our peace and safety at home and abroad, I yet to believe that the maintenance of rights and authority reserved to the states and to the people, not only essential to the adjustment and balance of the general system, but to the safeguard to the continuance of a free government. I consider it as a chief source of stability to our political system, whereas the consolidation of the states into one vast republic, sure to be aggressive abroad and despotic at home, will be the certain precursor of that ruin which has overwhelmed all those that have preceded it." Amen. Then, in continuing in the lengthy...
Unfortunately, due to a technical error, the rest of Scott's speech was not recorded. However, he was kind enough to share his notes with us, and I'm going to read the conclusion at this time. "Then, in a continuing and lengthy dissertation involving what Lee acknowledged as the widely understood right of secession since the time of the ratification conventions and how especially that right had been vociferously espoused by various northern states earlier in the 19th century, Lee explained to Acton how these ideas had been received from our forefathers. Lee goes on to relate to Acton the various measures taken by many in Virginia and elsewhere to save the Union and the compromise measures which were ultimately rejected by the North before asking the vital rhetorical question, and I quote, "Who then is responsible for the war?" End quote. Lee, having lived the experience, certainly knew the answer. Realizing the truth and making it known to others is certainly a clarion call to each of us here today. Robert E. Lee understood what was at stake when the Southern states seceded. His motto was, "Conquer or die." He foresaw that Southerners would have to risk everything, save honor, in order to have a chance to win their independence. Lee was the man who admitted on April 9, 1865, that he would, and I quote, "would rather die 1,000 deaths," end quote, than to do what duty forced to do at Appomattox. It is that truth. It is that honor. And it is that duty which calls us to action today. In remembering General Lee's actions and words, and in answering General Stephen Dill Lee's charge to the Sons of Confederate Veterans, It is my hope that no one will forget our great captain's famous summation of the course true Southerners took. In defending the memory of those who went before us, let us recall Robert E. Lee's immortal words, quote, "We could have pursued no other course without dishonor. And as sad as the results have been, if it had all to be done over again, we should be compelled to act precisely the same manner," end quote. Thank you.